Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And here is one central thing to know about the firing of police officer Daniel Pantaleo yesterday. He was fired by NYPD Commissioner James O'Neill, not for applying a banned chokehold to Eric Garner's throat, but for continuing to apply it after Garner was effectively subdued.
The NYPD court ruled that while certainly not preferable, that hold was acceptable during that brief moment in time because the risk of falling through the window was so high. But that exigent circumstance no longer existed, the court found, when Officer Pantaleo and Mr. Garner moved to the ground.
Commissioner O'Neill. So later this hour, we will play an extended excerpt of Commissioner O'Neill's statement announcing the firing of Officer Pantaleo. You've been hearing brief sound bites elsewhere. We will give you Commissioner O'Neill's complete rationale in his own words, a luxury of our long format, including what the famous video of the incident looked like to him and Commissioner O'Neill's agonized grappling with both sides. So that's coming up. First, though, with all the headline grabbers that have been in the news the last few days, you may have missed this story, which we could say is shocking in its simplicity. A U.S. appeals court on Thursday ruled that migrant children detained by the U.S. government must be given soap, dry clothes, and clean bedding. Should I say that again? Because it doesn't sound like a matter for federal court. It's true. A U.S. appeals court on Thursday ruled that migrant children detained by the U.S. government must be given soap, dry clothes, and clean bedding. And yes, I guess your tax dollars paid for the Trump administration's argument that the law does not require migrant children detained by the U.S. government to be given soap, dry clothes, and clean bedding. But that appeal was rejected. We'll see, I guess, if they decide to ask the United States Supreme Court to declare soap for detained children a discretionary amenity. My first guest today would have something to say about that. He is U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon. Because he serves out west in a state not called California, Senator Merkley is not so well known around here, but among other things that may jog your memory about who he is, Senator Merkley co-authored the Volcker Rule after the 2008 financial crisis. Remember that? The Volcker Rule, which prohibits banks from making some of the kinds of high-risk investments that help bring on the crisis and bring down the economy. Interestingly, Merkley, if I've got my history right, he'll confirm it or deny it, also voted against confirmation of Obama nominee Ben Bernanke for Federal Reserve Board chairman because he thought Bernanke was too easy on the banks before the crisis became full-blown. We'll see what he thinks today. Maybe some of you saw the New York Times website has a front-page story today about the too-big-to-fail banks wanting to ease the rules again right now for how much they need to keep in cash reserves for backup if their bubbles burst again. Jeff Merkley was the only U.S. senator to support Bernie Sanders for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2016. Merkley may be the only Democrat in the entire U.S. Senate to consider running for president in 2020, but decide to seek re-election instead. Okay, maybe that's an exaggeration. He filibustered the Supreme Court nomination of Neil Gorsuch for 15 hours on the Senate floor. And it was a video of Merkley at a child detention center in Brownsville, Texas, that went viral in June of last year and helped put the issue of family separation in the center of the American conversation. Did you ever watch this moment where he interacts with a police officer there who is not letting him in to inspect the facility?
I'm a U.S. senator.
Okay, sure.
Yes, and U.S. policy is involved right now with children. Are you familiar with this policy?
No, negative. Actually, this is not something that we specifically deal with. Okay. You know what I'm saying? But it was just like an idea and just an advice by sergeant that you're here.
Well, we won't take up their time anymore. But I think it's important for you all to be aware that it's been in the press all over the country that the children who were previously kept with their families under a new policy just implemented by the Attorney General are being separated from their families and warehoused here. And the Attorney General's team and the Office of the Refugee Settlement, they don't want anyone to know about what's going on behind these doors. This is why I tried to arrange a meeting to come And I really appreciated it when I came and called the number, and they said, yes, very happy to have a supervisor come out and talk to you. So I'm a little disappointed now that we're not getting that dialogue.
Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon last year in that video made in Brownsville, Texas. So Senator Merkley was very interested to see the appeals court ruling last week requiring soap, dry clothes, and clean bedding for detained kids in places like that. But do the Democrats have a plan of their own for asylum in the border? Senator Merkley also has a book now called America is Better Than This, Trump's War Against Migrant Families. Senator, thanks so much for coming on with us. Welcome to WNYC. Welcome to New York.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be with you.
I saw you tweeted about this ruling yesterday and the fact that this even went before a court. What's your reaction?
Well, it's absurd that here in the United States we go to the court just to say you have to provide basic hygiene and basic nutrition to children. But that tells you how far off track our federal government is. But the abuse starts long before children are even allowed across the border, when they're blockaded and left in Mexico without funds, without family, without friends. It's a whole series of levels of abuse that has to end, because this is not America.
For people wondering, how did they even argue this in court? My understanding is the Department of Homeland Security argued that the law specifying safe and sanitary conditions, I believe that's the wording in the law, safe and sanitary conditions, did not specifically contain the word soap or the words dry clothes or the words clean bedding. So the argument was these weren't really required. Was that your understanding?
That is correct. And can you imagine that? That the federal government, wouldn't they be absurdly embarrassed to argue that you don't have to provide basic sanitation to children, to refugees? But if this was the only piece of the puzzle, that would be a small piece. But there's so much more to this story, because it's founded on a theory of traumatizing children as a strategy to deter immigration. And that is a very dark and evil approach, not sustainable under any religious tradition, under any ethical framework.
And President Trump and some of his appointees have admitted as such. You want to avoid these family separations? First, don't come. Why do you think it's not working? Because the flow at the border remains massive and has for, long after word of these things got out and became so controversial.
What we've seen at the southern border is a shift from Mexican men primarily coming to work in the United States to families coming from the Northern Triangle, the countries of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And so I went down to examine the conditions there. I had been through Central America 40 years earlier, back in 1980, a long time ago. And what I found was that the conditions have deteriorated enormously. For example, the drug cartels have moved in. Second of all, street gangs have established themselves, such as the president of Guatemala said that every business in Guatemala pays extortion. You have a very large young population that has no work when they become of the age to find work. So you have an exceptional amount of stunting, just malnutrition. And you combine all that with also aspiration. And by that, what I mean is you can have a village with a shack, another shack, another shack, and then a very nice house built with remittances from someone from that village who went to America. And so children growing up go, we hear about Jose or Maria, who's made it to the U.S., and they have been able to help their family out so much. I'd like to be that person helping out my family.
But when you bring up aspiration, you cross a line that I think the Trump administration wants you to cross, which is to say they argue that many of the migrants are really more ordinary, quote unquote, economic migrants, and very nice that they want to come here and aspire to a better life, but many are taking advantage of the political asylum system, which is different and has lowered standards for admission, to get around the normal immigration applications and waiting times. And in fact, so many asylum applications, as you know, are rejected. So is family separation, is even the crisis in the three Central American countries you were talking about too narrow a lens through which to focus, or too exclusive a lens to really describe this flow?
Well, what we do see are a tremendous percentage of the refugees are fleeing violent persecution, domestic violence, gang violence, extortion that comes from the street level activity. I think about some of the mothers and daughters that I have met along the way, and they reflect that spectrum of fleeing domestic violence in one case, fleeing a death threat that came from the inability to repay a loan, another fleeing a death threat that came from not being able to pay the extortion on a beauty parlor. I mean, this is very, very real. And realize the U.S. is deeply connected to this in this sense. A lot of this came from the establishment of the drug cartels there, but where do they make their money? They make their money from selling those drugs in the United States of America. Where do they get the guns that they use to enforce? Those are guns that are smuggled from the United States of America. We don't make very little effort to stop them. A lot of the gang expertise was established in the 90s when we deported a lot of gang members from the United States of America. So we're very tied in to forces that have overwhelmed the traditional institutions of government and justice in those countries.
But should that overwhelm the definition of political asylum in terms of what it was originally meant to be? You mentioned domestic violence, and as you know, that's an issue right now. The Trump administration has reversed the previous policy of allowing asylum on those grounds if the governments of those countries won't enforce the safety of the domestic violence victims. The Times this weekend had an article with some real horror stories of women who then wanted to come to the United States. But the Trump people argue that that's obviously horrible, but political asylum is for people fleeing persecution as a group, like oppressed religious or racial minorities. So how do you argue that they belong here under political asylum?
Well, the definition does include persecuted groups, but it also includes individuals who have a credible fear of return. They do have the burden of proof to establish that, and so it is a difficult challenge.
For any reason, like if I go back to my country, my father's going to find me and beat me. Is that a reason for political asylum?
That has beat you, perhaps not, because it's a beating may not rise to the level, and it would be very hard to establish the evidence.
What's the level?
Well, it basically threat of your life or torture. So it has to be a very severe level of threat. You have to have the ability to prove it before a judge. And as you point out, most people who apply for asylum, even if they have legitimate experience, they can't get the information to be able to establish it in a court before an asylum judge. And so the point that many of us are making is simply that we have a system for adjudication, and that system needs to be allowed to work. But we cannot put ourselves in the position of deliberately abusing refugees as they await that opportunity to make their case. That's what is dark and evil about the administration. Deliberately injuring children, deliberately making life absolutely miserable for those who are awaiting an asylum hearing.
My guest is Democratic U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon. He's got a new book called America is Better Than This, Trump's War Against Migrant Families. By the way, if you want to see him in person, he'll be at the Strand, Broadway and 12th Street in Manhattan, tomorrow night at 7:30, tomorrow at 7:30 at the Strand for Senator Merkley. And listeners, we can take some questions for him on the set of issues that we've been talking about so far that his book is about, or anything else that you may have always wanted to ask Senator Merkley about, but you never had him over to dinner. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. By the way, whatever happened at that detention center, that former Walmart building in Brownsville, Texas, where you made your video last year, where they wouldn't let you in to inspect the conditions for the separated children?
Yes, so I was able to go back 2 weeks later. It was open to the press. It was open to a group of from Congress. It helps to go with numbers and with publicity. And what I found was that while the advocates had told me they thought hundreds of boys were in that building, maybe 1,000, it was actually 1,500. And the head of the organization that sponsored it, a nonprofit, the name of the facility, by the way, is Casa Padre, the basically said they had expanded from 300 boys to 1,500 over a period of just a couple months. And when I asked, well, did you have a lot of preparation for this? Did you make sure you had all that you needed? What were you missing? He said the biggest thing we were missing were mental health counselors. I asked him how many. He said 90. And he said, we just can't hire them. And it shows you how little planning went into the process of zero tolerance. In short order, zero tolerance became zero humanity. And that inhumanity begins with the border blockade. Many of your listeners will remember the picture a few weeks ago of a father, Oscar, and his daughter, Valeria, who died in the river trying to cross to the United States. And that was a powerful photo. They came to a port of entry, as the President of the United States has said to do. They came and they were rejected, and they were sent back into Mexico with no funds, no family, basically no friends, in a very hostile territory. And given that, they had very bad choices to choose from. The best choice was to try to get across the border and deliberately surrender to the United States authorities. They tried to do that because of the border blockade. They died because of it. And for the president to keep saying, just come to the port of entry and you'll be fine, and then to deliberately leave people stranded in Mexico, that is horrendous.
You ready for some pushback? Susan in Caldwell, you're on WNYC with Senator Jeff Merkley. Susan, thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Good morning, Susan.
Yeah, good morning. How are you? So I consider myself a progressive, but a couple of things. I do have to just note for the record that Obama was the one who started putting family in cages. And I know that there was a lot of litigation about that. And unfortunately, that opened the door for Trump. And a lot of us, I'm an immigration attorney, and a lot of us in this immigration field were trying to jump up and down and bring attention to this. But no one really paid attention until Trump started doing it. He didn't separate families, but now the fact that they're trying to keep families together, albeit in cages, started with Obama, unfortunately, with the Obama administration. And also under the Obama administration, I would like to ask, or you to ask the senator, I know, Brian, you mentioned in the beginning about, oh, what did the Democrats' plan have?
Mm-hmm.
I do remember several years ago that I forced myself to read a 500-page document that passed the House that included a lot of revisions to where the Gang of Eight came together, and they put some revisions on the asylum law, some being very, very good, getting rid of the one-year time frame, which is really stressful for people seeking asylum, and they don't speak English,
mm-hmm.
but they have to file within 1 year. Some people don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So I know they were doing revisions on that, and it passed the House, but it was never brought up by McConnell, and I just don't, it's just very frustrating that's not brought up more. I don't know what happened there. I don't know what's going on in the Senate, if you guys are still talking about doing something like that, if that's like it's still a seed, because some of it was good, I thought.
Great. Two great questions. First of all, Obama culpability for laying the groundwork for this.
So, Susan, the facility did exist that has the chain link cages, and it was used under the Obama administration. But child separation only occurred where there were severe background criminal elements, domestic abuse, child abuse, a very high level of crimes. What's different about zero tolerance strategy of the administration was it was about ripping children away from their parents when there was no justification of any kind. And thus the numbers were enormous. Now the administration, even after the court decision of June last year that shut down the front door for child separation, the administration is still, if they can find anything, if there is a DUI in someone's background, they separate the child from the parent. They are still doing it in every case they can get away with as part of this strategy of inflicting trauma on children.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to your second point, I just have to turn that around a little bit. It was the Senate that passed it. The Gang of Eight was in the Senate. It was the Democratic Senate. We passed it. We worked very hard with our Republican colleagues. We had a supermajority.
Right,
it was the House that mm-hmm. said, we will not bring this up under Republican control. And you're right. It was a comprehensive bill. It was bipartisan. But the Republicans wanted to preserve immigration as a broken system to campaign on, and they torched the bill.
I just wish that the Democrats that are going for presidency and going for the reelection would bring that up, basically to throw back in Republicans' faces, and people think, oh, they're taking our jobs and this border and we need to do something. Just to, I really wish that there was more focus on that, to bring it back to them and say, no, we did it. You're the ones that are, you know, and I think that are blocking, impeding it, the process. And I just, that's going in the future, that will
Susan,
be something, a strategy.
Thank you so much. So now the situation, Senator, has flipped, right? Because now the Democrats have the House, so presumably something like that could pass. Correct me if I'm wrong. But in the Senate, Mitch McConnell presumably wouldn't bring it to the floor.
Oh, that is correct. Many of my colleagues would revisit the 2013 they considered a foundation for fixing the immigration system, but they will not do so as long as the president is campaigning in basically aggravating the immigration as a 2020 November election issue. And notice that it's when it was 6 months out from the 2018 election in November, so 6 months earlier in May, that zero tolerance was put out there basically as a six-month strategy to accelerate the fear factor for the November election. The president didn't have Ebola. He didn't have ISIS. What did he have? Immigration. So thus, accentuating that crisis was his goal and his message.
And here we go again toward 2020. But as outrageous as the child separation policy is, the title of your book, and Susan kind of referred to this too in her call, suggests what some see as Democrats critiquing Trump without having a meaningful alternative of your own. The title again of Senator Merkley's book, I'm sure he'd be happy that I say the title again, America is Better Than This, Trump's War Against Migrant Families. Now, taking those ideas as given, or at least low-hanging political fruit, we do have tens of thousands or sometimes more asylum seekers coming to the border each month. What's the U.S. supposed to do with that number of people who would presumably need to be housed somewhere at taxpayer expense while their claims are heard?
Well, the numbers are much lower than back in 2000 when we had 200,000 people a month arriving. So let's put it into context. And the numbers have dropped way off now that we're in the summer season. We have handled these numbers before and done so treating refugees with dignity and respect rather than cruelty. And that's the point we're making. There is an asylum process. People do get adjudicated. They do get returned if they can't demonstrate legitimate, credible fear of return. But do not inflict trauma by the U.S. on people as part of the formula.
But is there decent housing for tens of thousands of people a month?
Yes, actually there is. And this is, so if we go back in time, we've been able to provide sponsored housing, and we've had a program called the Family Case Management Program. That Family Case Management Program went through two reviews by the Inspector General under President Trump. And the reviews found that 99% of the families showed up for their hearings, and that included their asylum hearing. So what happened with the Trump administration? They should have loved this program because it meant people showed up for adjudication.
Is this what Trump calls catch and release?
Well, this is the opposite of catch and release. This was a provision that said we are going to have a case manager that monitors people carefully, make sure they show up. Trump's argument is people don't show up. But what did Trump do with this program? He torched it. He destroyed it. He eliminated it because it actually solved the problem, and he wanted to accentuate the problem.
Martha in Queens, you're on WNYC with Senator Jeff Merkley. Hi, Martha.
Hi. I was just wondering, to what extent does the Central American Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA, contribute to the displacement of farmers and peasants in Central America?
So I went down with Senator Tom Carper to meet with the social groups, the economic experts, and newspapers, and the government officials in the three countries of the Northern Triangle. And I did not find that CAFTA came up as a significant contributor. What I did find is they've had years of drought that have resulted in the failure of a lot of rural farming, a lot of corn and coffee. What I found was a high, very high murder rates, unbelievable. unbelievably high in any place in the world that doesn't have an actual war going on. And this is the gang and extortion culture. Also found that they have a very high birth rate. That means a lot of young people do not have jobs when they need jobs. So there's a lot of desperation that comes from that. But CAFTA did not specifically come up as a significant force.
Where are you on free trade, quote unquote, generally? Because it used to be more the Democrats than the Republicans who would argue that the globalization of the economy was, you know, destroying the middle class in this country. Trump ran on that and got elected.
Well, on this, I think Trump had a valid point to make. If you give your competitor overseas, who runs a factory that makes the same things you make, the ability to have full access to your market but operate with lower wages and lower environmental rules and lower labor rules, you give your competitor a huge advantage, and the result is you go out of business. The only way you stay in business is if you go overseas and take advantage of those same low wages and low environmental rules. And so we devastated manufacturing across America. And that's a very legitimate point. I agree with him on that. I don't agree that he has a coherent plan to address it. But the basic premise that if you give your competitors overseas an advantage, you'll destroy jobs here in America, that is correct.
Steve in Yonkers, you're on WNYC with Senator Jeff Merkley. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thank you for taking my call again, Brian.
Sure.
One thing I did just want to mention, you had mentioned murder rates just now. St. Louis, in our own country, has a murder rate within that city higher than any Central American nation, which is a real embarrassment for this country. But the question I wanted to ask was to the senator, I know you have this legislation to protect migrant children, but are you also behind any legislation now to reform immigration that might include quotas as well?
Are you asking a version of, are you Democrats for open borders?
You could frame it that way as well.
Democrats have been very supportive of security at the border, security for overstaying visas, security at point of employment. Those are the three key points. They were all in the bipartisan bill that virtually all of us supported back in 2013. The issue here isn't to say open borders, because that is not what we're arguing. What we're arguing is human rights violations, deliberate cruelty towards refugees and particularly towards children is absolutely morally unacceptable.
There are political analysts who are saying now the Democrats risk maybe the presidential election in 2020 or some other elections because things have become so polarized that all the Democrats seem to do is criticize Trump for his excesses, but have moved off that old, more centrist position of course we have to have strong border enforcement, and we're for this and this and this, and going after the employers who hire people who are here illegally. And it's all about Trump cruelty now and how we should be more welcoming. And, you know, for some people, it's about decriminalizing the border and things that to some quote-unquote moderate suburban swing voters in this country are going to sound extreme on the other side.
You know, I think about two different bills. There's a bill put forward by Senator Tillis that said we need to be able to lock up children indefinitely, and it had 40 Republican sponsors. My bill, which says end or stop the cruel treatment of children, migrant children, has 40 Democratic sponsors. What a contrast. I cannot believe that 40 U.S. senators have weighed in to establish internment camps for thousands and thousands of migrants. We had internment camps in World War II. We know it was a huge mistake. We have a program that works very well for migrant families, the Family Case Management Program. Not only that, but it costs at least 20 to 40 times more to lock people up than to have a case manager for them. So this is a huge contrast driven by the politicization of immigration by President Trump.
Before you go, let me get your take on a few other things in the news. Am I right that you are the only U.S. senator to support Bernie Sanders?
That is correct.
Bernie Sanders.
Except
over
for Bernie. So there's two of us.
That, I guess Bernie should be included in that category. Are you supporting him again for 2020?
I'm not making any endorsements for some long time to come.
What do you consider the biggest issue in your state of Oregon for the next president, whoever that is?
The corruption of our Constitution. This is the fundamental issue of gerrymander, voter suppression, dark money that has turned our government into government by and for the powerful instead of the people. As a result, we are not addressing the foundations for families, healthcare, housing, education, and jobs, and we're not addressing carbon pollution, which is having devastating climate chaos impacts on my state of Oregon.
You filibustered Neil Gorsuch's Supreme Court nomination?
15 hours and 30 minutes.
Don't forget the 30 minutes. Those last 30 minutes were probably the hardest. But now many Democrats are calling for an end to the filibuster as an institution, so the Senate can rule by a 51% majority, not 60%, with all the gridlock that brings. What's your position?
The Republicans had two top priorities. One was Supreme Court nominees. The second was tax cuts for the wealthy. They changed the rules to simple majority for both of those priorities. We should have the same grit and determination to pass an agenda by simple majority for the people of the United States on health care, housing, education, and jobs.
All right. And we leave it there with U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley, Democrat from Oregon. His new book is America is Better Than This, Trump's War Against Migrant Families. He'll be appearing in person, if you want to see him in person, at the Strand tomorrow night at 7:30. Senator Merkley, thank you so much for making this one of your stops.
It's wonderful to be with you. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come.